This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what will U.S.-Africa policy look like in a Trump administration? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. During the campaign, the Trump team did not speak much about foreign policy in general, let alone U.S.-Africa policy in particular. Will Donald Trump favor continuing programs, which both Democratic and Republican administrations have championed, such as the African Growth and Opportunity Act, PEPFAR, that's the program to combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis, Millennium Challenge Corporation programs, Power Africa, and Feed the Future? Will counterterrorism efforts against Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and Al-Shabaab in Somalia continue apace? With so many competing regional challenges and threats around the world, where will Africa fit among a new administration's foreign policy priorities? With us to discuss U.S. engagement with Africa in a prospective Trump administration are two distinguished regional analysts. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based in. He advised the presidential campaigns of former Republican nominees Senator John McCain and Governor Mitt Romney, and is the author of the recent article, Why Trump Should Make Africa a Foreign Policy Priority, published in The Hill. And Ambassador David Shin. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, currently Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University. He blogs at the official blog of Ambassador David H. Shin. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
J. Peter Pham, let me begin with you, since you just wrote this article, Why Trump Should Make Africa a Foreign Policy Priority. Talk about your arguments about why he should make Africa a foreign policy priority.
Thank you, Carol. To put things into context, Africa has largely been invisible, not just in this political campaign, but really the last five. In fact, a while back, I went and looked at all the debate questions in the general election, for the last five presidential elections for both the presidential and vice presidential debates. And the only time Africa explicitly came up as a topic was actually back in 2008, the vice presidential debate, when a question was posed about the crisis at that time in Darfur. So it's not uncommon that Africa, unfortunately for those of us who love her and work on her, is largely invisible during the presidential campaign. But that doesn't mean that it should or would remain invisible in the administration. And for a Trump administration, I would cite two reasons why Africa can and should be a foreign policy priority. First, the president-elect has stated very, very clearly and unapologetically that his first and foremost objective is the interest of the United States, the American people, and the security of the same. And one can make an argument, and I do, that America's security and her national interest, for a variety of reasons, finds a place in Africa because of the security challenges and the opportunities in Africa. Secondly, the voters, if they said nothing else in this last election, they're tired of gridlock and business as usual. And one of the few areas that a new administration, and I would have said this if it had been the other way around and we were facing President-elect Hillary Clinton, is that one of the few areas that there's large bipartisan comity in Washington is on the issue of Africa. Look at the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which you mentioned, Carol. That was renewed last year by lopsided margins in Congress. So there's broad bipartisan consensus on sound Africa policy. So it's an area where a new administration can show early on leadership that's bipartisan across the aisles.
Turning to you now, Ambassador David Shin, for your take on how you think a President Trump would calibrate U.S. policy toward Africa.
I don't take any exception to what Peter just suggested. I would suggest that in terms of priority towards Africa or about Africa in any administration, it actually goes back even further than Peter suggested. Ever since the end of World War II, Africa has been at the bottom of the U.S. foreign policy priority list in terms of grand regions around the world. And when things are at the bottom, they don't raise much interest in presidential campaigns. Now, there was one issue that did come up in this campaign that does concern Africa, albeit North Africa, and that was U.S. policy in Libya, and particularly the period when Secretary Clinton was dealing with Libyan policy and the deaths of four of our people in Benghazi. And that was really the only issue concerning Africa that came up during the campaign. Now, of course, we're looking to the future and trying to ascertain where a Trump administration will go. And we don't have an awful lot to go on. There are some shards out there that I've been able to dredge up in terms of tweets and whatnot. But beyond that, and I'll be happy to cite those, but beyond that, we don't have a lot to judge where the administration will go.
Back to you, J. Peter Pham. Because we don't have a lot of information about where we're going, because, as you said, Africa wasn't mentioned much, nor was foreign policy a major issue in the campaign, what is your sense of where we're going to go in a Trump administration? More continuity with Obama and George W. Bush? Where do you see divergence? What areas, sectors might be prioritized over others?
The president-elect made very clear throughout the campaign that security is going to be a major plank in his policy and a major concern. And we've seen that also in the prioritization of the nominations of senior officials. It started with the National Security Advisor and after the Chief of Staff and White House strategists. So security is going to be a big one, and certainly that figures in Africa. The security challenges in Africa, you cited some of them earlier, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Daesh, or the so-called Islamic State, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab. In fact, on Election Day, I was in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria, where the fight is ongoing, and it's changing literally as we speak, the fight against Boko Haram. And there's very clear evidence of increasing foreign presence in that fight. So in these theaters, I think you'll expect engagement. You can derive that from what was said already during the campaign. Economic issues. AGOA has largely been a one-sided thing. It was a concession given to sub-Saharan African states. And it's been a good program. It's increased business, and it's also created jobs, including in the United States. But I think we're in a period where, and Congress made very clear last year in the renewal, that AGOA in its current form will not be renewed. It has to be transformed to a more two-way street. So there's room for an economic agenda, especially one that gives American business more level playing field. Development assistance and humanitarian assistance, I think, are areas that are going to probably be re-examined. The American people are remarkably generous when it comes to disasters and catastrophes and responding to humanitarian need. I think where there's been greater ambiguity and lack of political consensus has been on some of the development aid programs, which are going to have to be examined. And where that leads, we will see. Now, there's been broad continuity to date on that. President Bush quadrupled the level of U.S. foreign assistance to sub-Saharan Africa. And President Obama, to his credit, largely maintained it at the Bush levels, give or take some things, which is amazing in a period of fiscal constraints when foreign assistance to most areas of the world was cut by maybe about 20%, roughly. Will this be maintained? I think that remains to be seen. If it is, I would suspect that it would probably, there might be some redirection or repurposing of how it's spent, but I think that remains to be seen.
Turning to you, Ambassador Shin, for your take on which sectors could be strengthened and which might be weakened under a Trump administration.
I think the questions that I ask myself is, as far as where the administration is going, is whether the protectionist proclivities of President-elect Trump will have any kind of negative impact on the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, for example. They may not, but it's a question that I have. Will he be less supportive of foreign aid to Africa? Don't know the answer to that, but it's something that I would be asking about. He has kind of an interesting relationship with South Africa. That is something on which he has tweeted and spoken about on a couple of occasions, on the one hand praising Nelson Mandela, on the other hand calling the situation in South Africa a mess economically, and raising questions as to, well, if it is a mess, what might he do about it? And we all know that the current government in South Africa has not been very supportive of U.S. policy. In fact, it's been sometimes quite hostile. The Obama administration has been surprisingly tolerant of that attitude out of South Africa. Will the Trump administration be as tolerant of a rather hostile government in South Africa as the Obama administration has been? Another question in my mind. I'm just not sure which way it will go.
Turning back to you, J. Peter Pham, and on a sort of lighter note, Ambassador Shin mentioned South Africa, and we note that we have a South African host of a satirical program called The Daily Show. Trevor Noah is the host of that show. And as you know, it's full of satirical material, not to be taken too seriously. But looking at Donald Trump, he said that Donald Trump reminded him of some African strongmen by his rhetoric. He compared him to Robert Mugabe and a few others who have said, you know, only I can fix your problems. Everybody loves me. I'm very rich. You know, again, making a joke about it. And in that regard, I wanted to ask you, how do you see sort of that perception of Donald Trump in Africa? What has been the reaction by Africans to his election?
It's been interesting, and it varies from country to country and individuals and where they are in society. And I've simultaneously heard reactions of horror. On the other hand, a number of people I've met with, officials, and this was before the election results came in, were actually applauding a firm hand toward it. So I think it's very mixed. And also, where is the country positioned? The countries that are advocating or at least have positioned themselves publicly as strong partners, whether they're or not, we can look in greater detail, on counterterrorism, countering violent extremism, like some of the things they've heard. Other countries are a little more concerned, those who are more dependent upon aid programs or have a different worldview. So I think there's a great variety. Just like it would be a mistake to view Africa as one country, as one American political actor thought 8 years ago, it would be a mistake to interpret African reactions to the new president-elect. It's telling that there are some African leaders who reached out very quickly after the election and have some points of commonality.
Indeed. Well, David Shin, we acknowledge that Egyptian President Sisi was one of the first who reached out to him. But again, this is sort of the strongman image. And again, the same question to you. What kind of reaction have you gotten from your African friends to the election of Donald Trump? Are they concerned about that image, which harks back to not a good era in African politics in many ways? And we're wondering whether or not democracy or the importance of promoting democracy will even be a plank for the Trump administration?
Well, for the most part, and these are Africans in the diaspora, which is sometimes a different attitude than what you would get from those living in Africa itself. It's one of wait and see, which is fair enough, and I would encourage them to take that position. But you mentioned specifically Presidents Mugabe and Museveni, and it's interesting that in January of 2016, then-candidate Trump made comments in Washington before American war veterans that Mugabe and Museveni must be put on notice that their days are numbered and that I'm going to arrest them and lock them in prison. Now, he may have been joking. It's not at all clear what was going on at that particular event. But it was interesting that Museveni immediately responded in a very sort of hostile manner to that remark. But then, interestingly, Museveni was one of the first presidents to congratulate President-elect Trump after the electoral victory.
And what about the very large Muslim population of the African continent? And given words by President-elect Trump in the campaign, at least?
My guess is there's much more concern in that community, and it's going to be up to the administration to reassure these folks that nothing of harm will befall them as a result of U.S. policy changes.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador David Shin, from whom you just heard. He's former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, currently professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based here in Washington. We're previewing what U.S.-Africa policy might look like in a prospective Trump administration. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Herbert Daniel from Jos, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, J. Peter Pham. Of course, there are a number of burning crises that need to be dealt with immediately on the continent, whether in South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo. How do you think the incoming administration will be able to get up to speed? Will they?
One of my concerns, Carol, going forward is actually some of these crises don't play by an American timetable. You know, the first crisis you mentioned there, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we're a little more than 3 weeks away from the expiration of President Joseph Kabila's second and final constitutional term, expires the 19th of December, almost exactly 1 month before the new president is inaugurated, so in the very last month of the outgoing U.S. administration. Clearly, all indications are he's going to remain in office. How are we going to deal with that? The U.S. has been in front of its allies on sanctions to certain leading regime officials. How are we going to react in the waning days of the Obama administration? And then who's going to be managing this account as the new administration comes on board and getting officials confirmed and into place? So it's a very critical time, yet we're in a phase of transition. The same could be said, certainly, this crisis in South Sudan with the heartbreaking crisis there and the millions of people displaced. But the increasingly bleak humanitarian picture in northeastern Nigeria. Nigerian military has had some successes. I was just there literally on the front, literally at the edge of the Sambisa Forest just over 2 weeks ago. And there are perhaps some successes which have not been heralded. At the same time, there's a significant humanitarian deficit going on there as well. So quite a number of crises, and these are not going to wait for anyone. And that is a concern for me as someone who follows Africa very closely.
Ambassador Shin, what worries you as we're in this sort of transition phase in the so-called lame duck era of President Obama, and between that and the incoming administration, what areas in Africa do you think could suffer? And is the bureaucracy strong enough?
I think the crises that are out there today, and I would add to Peter's list the situation in Somalia, which is far from being resolved and if anything, maybe getting slightly worse, to that list is the people in the bureaucracy, the government institutions as they exist will be able to cope with these problems during the lame duck session. I'm not really concerned about that. The biggest problem is immediately after the transition, because the new team is not fully in place. And it takes months to get everyone confirmed by the Senate, for them to get their senior people in the various departments. And that's where things tend to go awry. I went through that with Somalia in 1992, 1993. And you could see an enormous amount of slippage going from George H.W. Bush to William Clinton during that period of time in Somalia, because it was the bureaucracy that was running things at a critical time. And it hurt. You really needed to have political leadership in place at that point. So I would see all of these issues as being troublesome in the days immediately after January 20, just because the people are not in place.
Turning back to you, J. Peter Pham, I wonder if we could look at Obama's legacy as he concludes his second term. Obama's Africa legacy on the continent. He promoted trade. We talked about many of the other programs that he actually continued from George W. Bush. But he had a special penchant to talk to the youth of Africa. He instituted this so-called YALI program to promote African youth. How would you characterize his legacy? And do you think that particular program might continue?
I think U.S.-Africa policy has a very strong tradition, one that I hope continues, of continuity and bipartisan comedy. By and large, I spoke earlier about how President Obama continued the foreign assistance that levels that President George W. Bush put into place. And there's the continuity between President Clinton, President Bush, and President Obama on the AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And so there's great continuity, and one hopes that continuity perdures. The first Obama term might be characterized as a little bit of a disappointment. Although a veteran and seasoned diplomat, accomplished Ambassador Johnny Carson was confirmed and sworn in as Assistant Secretary for African Affairs by April of 2009, it wasn't until later that year that an ambassador to the African Union was appointed, Michael Battle. And then it was not until the fourth year of the first term that there was a Senate-confirmed assistant administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development for Africa. So it took a long time to get the team in place. So the first term, perhaps there was a bit of disappointment. The second term, I think a lot has been made. The U.S.-Africa Summit, the largest gathering of African leaders ever convened by a U.S. president. You mentioned the Young African Leaders Initiative. It only affects about 1,000 young people a year, but there are 1,000 young people who are leaders already and are going back. One would hope that the means are somehow found to actually expand and grow that program beyond the 1,000. I would say the biggest legacy piece that President Obama leaves in Africa, quite frankly, is what I call a state of mind. The discourse on Africa has gone a complete 180. We're now talking about Africa as an opportunity, as an opportunity for a win-win between the United States and Africa, the economic opportunities, the social, cultural links, as well as the political and strategic links. Africa's opportunity is new. When Ambassador Shea and I were talking about it, the same thing a decade or more ago, people would look at us as if we needed help of a kind that came with guys in white suits. But now it's accepted. I think mainstreaming that discourse and changing the mentality, it's something that's not easily quantifiable, but I think it's something that should be recognized.
Ambassador Shin, anything to add or subtract about Obama's legacy in the continent?
Well, I would certainly agree with Peter that I would hope that the Trump administration would continue the two signature initiatives of the Obama administration, in addition to some of the earlier, longer-standing initiatives like AGOA and like the Millennium Challenge Corporation, but especially Power Africa on the one hand and the African Young Leaders Initiative on the other. I think these are solid initiatives. You can tweak them, you can fiddle with them, whatever, but they're basically sound initiatives. And I would think that Power Africa would appeal to someone like President-elect Trump because of the emphasis on infrastructure, although it is one of those initiatives back in 2013 that he tweeted on in a very negative way. But I think probably because he didn't fully understand it at that time, it looked like a $7 billion giveaway at that point in time, and that's not what it is at all. But the tweet, which are very short, was quite negative.
All right. Well, let's hope he listens to both of you. And as we close, back to you, J. Peter Pham, to talk about competition between the United States and China in Africa. That's been going on for quite some time. China seems to be overtaking U.S. in terms of trade and influence. This has to be seen as worrying. How do you see this trend going forward under a Trump administration?
Well, I think one has to be always realistic at assessing what China is doing anywhere in the world, but including in Africa. I think there's a tendency among some to look at it with rosy-tinted glasses, and there's an equal tendency on others to alarmism. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. But there are strategic stakes. This year, China broke ground on its first military base anywhere overseas, and it's in Djibouti, where the U.S. has a military presence as well at Camp Le Moynier. This is not an accident that it is there. And one has to look at that and appraise accordingly. One shouldn't be alarmed necessarily, but this is a strategic move, a very clear one. China has also surpassed the U.S. as, in fact, it did so several years ago, as Africa's largest trading partner. On the other hand, China does not directly invest in Africa in the way we define investment, of putting money at risk, if you will, foreign direct investment. The U.S., Britain, and France are actually the three largest single investors. China's a very distant fourth. Many of China does in Africa and infrastructure is actually based on credits and loans, and some of the conditions on those and payback conditions are actually quite one-sided in Africa's disadvantage. So there's an opportunity here. We can't compete in the same way, and we shouldn't necessarily, but I think there are things to be examined.
The last word to you, Ambassador Shin, on China's increasing influence in Africa, and to what extent that's negative for the United States, for an incoming administration? Should they be worried about that?
China's engagement in Africa has a very mixed picture for the United States. There are pluses and there are minuses. There obviously is competition on the commercial side, on competing for contracts, but we compete with the Germans and the French and everyone else in those areas. In the security area, there's actually been some collaboration, mutual support for UN peacekeeping operations, for example, countering piracy in the Gulf of Aden, and cooperation between China and the U.S. And as Peter said, although China surpassed us in 2009 in terms of being a trade partner with Africa, in fact, they're now double U.S. trade with Africa, according to U.S. and Chinese official statistics, we have about twice as much foreign direct investment in Africa as China does. We have about $8 billion a year in foreign assistance going to Africa compared to $2.5 billion from China. So there are areas where the United States is way ahead of China, although China tends to get the benefit of the doubt when it comes to how it's dealt with in the media. They're doing the big infrastructure projects, even though they're making money on most of those projects, and that gets a lot of attention, both in the media and on the African continent, for which they really get enormous credit.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to correct the record on that. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador David Shin. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He's also vice president for research and regional initiatives. Gentlemen, as always, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.